is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, November 28th, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. The New Democratic Party of Canada is currently looking for its new leader after the resignation of Jagmeet Singh and a colossal decline in support in the most recent federal election. It seems the NDP's reduced support stems from competition with the Liberals, strategic voting, demographic shifts, and difficulties uniting diverse voter groups across Canada. The new leader of the NDP must unite the party's diverse voter groups, rebuild national support, and clearly differentiate the NDP's vision from its rivals. But how can this be done? Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian, and assistant professor at the School of Public Policy at Simon Fraser University, Daniel Westlake, discuss this question and more this week on Rabble Radio. Here are Sarah Sahagian and Daniel Westlake in conversation. Take a listen.
In the last federal election cycle, the NDP lost official party status and went down to just 7 seats. As a researcher, what do you see as the main factors that contributed to that pretty stark decline? That's staggering.
Yeah, so I think we're still waiting on election study data that will allow us to dig into this more. But there are some factors that I think jump out as somebody who's watching the election as likely causes of this. The NDP does well when they can focus an election on redistribution, welfare state issues, these kinds of economic issues that are domestic economic issues. And so much of that election that we had this past spring was about international relations, tariffs, dealing with Donald Trump. And it's not clear where the NDP fit in that debate. So this kind of is two problems for the NDP. First off, it's not always clear what the NDP is offering that the Liberals aren't when it comes to dealing with Trump and tariffs. And if that's the thing that's in voters' minds, well, it's hard for them to make an argument that is different than what the Liberals or even the Conservatives are arguing, right? We need to stand up to Donald Trump. We need to find ways to support our industries. All of that stuff is being said by everybody. And that's a problem when you're a third party. The second issue there is that the argument for strategic voting starts to increase, right? If the question is, who do you want to deal with Donald Trump? Well, when the NDP or the third party, the answer to that question is not going to be Jagmeet Singh. It's either going to be Mark Carney or Pierre Poilievre, depending on your partisan leaning or depending on how you view those particular leaders. That creates a really challenging environment for the NDP. So the good news for the NDP going forward is Trump is not going to be in office forever. Hopefully, this kind of troubled relationship with the United States is not going to go on forever. And so when we get an election that's focused on different issues, maybe there's space for them to come back. The bad news is they lose a lot of resources because they're not having official party status. And so the ability to exploit these opportunities to kind of recover is going to be a challenge that the NDP faces moving forward.
Which parties do you think might be siphoning off the NDP's support and why? I'm just curious to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, so I'm pretty convinced that it's Liberal vote. Like a lot of that vote went to the Liberals. There's some in some particular ridings, in some particular parts of the country where the Conservatives have made gains. I'm thinking areas like Windsor. But if you just look at the general trends in Liberal support and NDP support over the course of that election, when the Liberals went up, the NDP went down. The Conservatives made most of their gains between the 2021 election, the 2025 election, when Trudeau was really unpopular, when the Liberal vote share was collapsing, and the NDP was pretty much stagnant. So it's not great for the NDP that the Liberal vote is collapsing and they're not picking up, but it also suggests there's not a lot of NDP vote going over to the Conservatives. What we then saw when Mark Carney became leader is Liberal vote share increased, NDP vote share dropped. And that suggests to me that the NDP lost a lot of vote to the Liberals.
So is this a situation, I know that people in the past have talked about ranked ballots, is this a situation where does your intuition tell you that a ranked ballot might have changed the outcome?
Probably not. So in general, when I've looked at ranked ballots, the impact on election results is quite limited. If you look, so Australia uses a ranked ballot system. In something like 80 to 90% of the seats in those elections, the candidate that's ahead in the first count ends up being the candidate that wins the seat. I expect in Canada, like there are so many seats where the candidate that wins is winning with 40, 45% of the vote, probably pick up that 5% on the second ballot. But then what's worse for the NDP, right? And I think ranked ballots would be really bad for the NDP, is that you're going to have a lot of conservatives that, I mean, maybe they put the PPC second, but they're going to put the Liberals before they put the NDP. And so the Liberals are going to pick up votes from the conservatives in cases where you've got Liberal versus NDP races. Probably you get Liberals putting the NDP second, but some Liberals might put the Conservatives second. And so that could create problems for the NDP and NDP Conservative races. And then the NDP, to be able to win a seat in a ranked ballot system, you kind of have to finish top two to start picking up second and third choice votes. And the NDP doesn't finish second in a lot of cases. And so it's hard to see where the NDP benefits from a ranked ballot system. It's important to know this is very different than a proportional system where the NDP would very much benefit. But that ranked ballot system, if it helps any party, it helps the Liberals because they're the second choice of more voters probably than the NDP.
I mean, it seems like proportional representation would normally greatly benefit the NDP, but this time, because they only won 6% of the vote, it doesn't really feel like it would benefit them too much. Yes, they would have more seats, but they'd still have very few. So what do you think would tangibly benefit the NDP in the next election cycle?
So I actually still think the NDP would benefit from proportional representation fairly significantly. I mean, 6% of the vote in a 300-seat legislature, they're probably not dealing with the same concerns over official party status in a proportional system that they are today. Maybe in a proportional system, they don't have to deal with as much strategic voting, and that may push their vote a little higher. Proportional representation was never putting the NDP on its own into official opposition status. They were not winning enough votes for it to do that. So I think they do have gains to make under a different electoral system. That being said, the electoral system's not going to keep the NDP from finishing third or finishing fourth. To do that, the NDP needs to expand their electoral coalition. And this is really hard at a time when social democratic parties around the world are seeing their vote share drop. And it's because I think their electoral coalitions are more fragmented. Social democratic parties used to win by uniting middle-class progressives and working-class voters. That is increasingly hard to do, especially in an environment like Canada, where you've got a party like the Liberals that really plays well to middle-class progressives. They're a party that offers a lot. Well, I mean, at least under Justin Trudeau, offered a lot on environmental questions, on LGBTQ plus rights, on gender equality, and weren't proposing the same amounts of redistribution as you might see from the NDP. So if you're a middle-class voter that is progressive, that wants some welfare state, but not like the amount of welfare state that the NDP wants environmental policy, wants gender, the Liberals fit that voter very well. And that creates a problem for the NDP. They can speak well, I think, to working class voters, to voters that benefit from further welfare state expansion. But I'm not sure what they're offering on other questions is different enough from the Liberals to get them out of kind of a very left-leaning, very pro-redistribution base of support. I don't know what that means for the NDP moving forward. I think there's enough there for them to be the kind of third party that we saw in the 2019 and 2021 elections. I don't know that there's enough for them to replace the Liberals as the party competing for government.
That's interesting. So we've seen recent numbers about the youth unemployment numbers. And so I feel like the youth vote, if we can get youth to vote, could play a pivotal role in the next election. What do you think is going to happen with the youth vote? I know that definitely the Conservatives will try to pounce on that, as well as the NDP, all the opposition parties. I mean, the Bloc Québécois will also try to use that to their advantage. Everyone will. What do you think is going to play out, and how do you think the youth vote will be weaponized because of youth unemployment and just sort of general discontent?
I think in general, the NDP tends to do better with younger voters. And I don't expect that to change. And I think voters who are more economically precarious positions tend to be NDP voters. So I see this in my data, voters that are lower income, voters that don't have university degrees, that's where the NDP support is compared to the Liberal Party. If you've got a lot of youth who are struggling economically, that's a potential base that the NDP can tap into. I don't know that there's enough there. Like, youth unemployment cannot stay this low forever without it being a serious problem that needs to be addressed by governments. I think Liberals realize this. I think the challenge for the NDP and youth voters is what happens when you have more educated younger voters working their way up into the economy and starting to pick up jobs that are more comfortable, starting to leave this or be in a less precarious position. Those kinds of voters can shift over to Liberal voters, right? Because if we look at the Liberal vote base, it's people who, I mean, income does less for Liberal support either way. But university-educated voters are more likely to be Liberal voters. And so if you get rid of the economic precarity or reduce the economic precarity, what you have with youth voters, maybe as they hit their 30s and 40s, are well-educated, socially progressive, environmentalist voters, often in the middle of cities. And those are Liberal voters. The other thing that might be worth noting here, on questions of diversity, it is not clear that the NDP has any kind of advantage over the Liberals. It's not clear that support on policy questions really separates the parties. And then ethno-racial minorities and immigrants from the global south are consistently Liberal voters. They're not New Democrats. And so as the Canadian population becomes more diverse, that's a problem for the NDP, not necessarily because the NDP is hostile to diversity, but because over years and years and years of trying to win that vote from the Liberals, they have failed.
It's interesting because you talked about how people kind of, there's this pipeline from being maybe more progressive to voting for the Liberals as you become more economically established. And definitely it makes sense if that would be in someone's interest. If, you know, they have more money, they feel like they don't want to give them as much of it away. But how much do you think of that as strategic voting? Because I think there's a big strategic voting factor in play. I live in Toronto, and a lot of people in Toronto don't want to vote Liberal. They just see it as their duty to do that to save the country from the Conservatives. That's how they perceive it. And they just stand in these long lines waiting basically to vote against the Conservatives.
Strategic voting matters. I think that's unquestioned in the Canadian context. But the way I see strategic voting, it's not something that changes the order of the political parties. It's something that increases the gap between parties that are already apart from each other, right? So you have to ask before we ask, like, how is strategic voting affecting the NDP? Why aren't the NDP the strategic option, right? If you had a bunch of voters, or if you had more voters that wanted to vote NDP than Liberal, the NDP would finish ahead of the Liberals or would start to push ahead of the Liberals. And you'd have Liberals in the situation where they are strategic voting for the NDP. And if you go to a country like Britain, that's kind of what happens, right? If you've got leftist Liberal Democratic voters, they vote Labour to keep the Conservatives out, right? So certainly that strategic voting matters, but there's something else that's putting the NDP behind the Liberals to start with. And it's those things that put the NDP in third place that are necessary to create the strategic voting effect that hurts the NDP. If the NDP was able to mobilize enough voters to either run even with the Liberals or run slightly ahead of the Liberals, they wouldn't have the strategic voting problem. The Liberals would have the strategic voting problem. That's not the case. It's the Liberals have consistently been able to put themselves ahead of the NDP, and then strategic voting then reduces the NDP's vote share even further.
Do we think that part of this is perception? Because the tricky part with strategic voting is you kind of have to guess. You have to guess, if I vote strategically for this party, which party will my neighbors be voting strategically for? And based on history and what you've seen, when you're trying to do that guesswork at the ballot box, you think, I guess Liberal, safer bet. Do we think that it's kind of the NDP is being doomed by the fact that just they have not yet broken through to form a federal government?
Maybe to a degree. So I don't think it's just a question of perception. I think there's probably some of that there. But I think we can look at the 2011 and 2015 elections and what happens during those elections as evidence of that there's something more going on here. And I think the reason is in 2011 and 2015, there are points which the NDP is the strategic option. Fortunately for the NDP in 2011, it's the end of the election, so they actually form official opposition. But I think it's worth noting, a good chunk in the first kind of month or two at the beginning of the 2015 election, the NDP was running ahead of the Liberals and looked like the strategic option. And a couple of things happened during the election that I think expose some of the challenges the NDP faces. The first is the Liberal promise of deficit spending and a middle-class tax cut funded by the wealthy. Mm. And so the Liberals pitch this as leftism, but they're really redistributing from the upper class to the middle class. Mm. While the NDP is making an argument for things like childcare, which I think has broader benefits, and pharmacare, which I think is actually a low-income promise. And the reason is a lot of middle-income individuals, public sector and are working in jobs where they have benefits that cover a lot of pharmacare. Mm-hmm. And so you had these differences in who the parties were appealing to. And I think the promises those parties made really revealed that. Mm-hmm. And I think the shifts we saw in English Canada spoke to the way that it's more than just perception there. What was being offered to different voters was different and they reacted to it. The other big one, and this is a consistent problem of the NDP, is what happens in Quebec. Historically, the challenge for the NDP is you have a bunch of left-leaning voters in Quebec who want a larger welfare state, who are nationalist and will not look at the NDP because they perceive the NDP as hostile to Quebec's interests. Over the course of the 20th century, the story is the NDP is promising all these national programs. Quebec doesn't, a lot of these nationalists don't want national programs, they want provincial programs. In 2015, it breaks on cultural issues where the NDP faces this problem. The NDP had won over a lot of left-leaning nationalist voters in that 2011 election. When the question of religious accommodation gets put to the forefront in that election, what had happened is the Supreme Court made a ruling on niqabs and citizenship, basically saying you have to allow people to wear a niqab during a citizenship ceremony, puts the issue front and center. At that point, the NDP vote share in Quebec declines. Like, you don't need to know when that ruling happened to know when it happened. All you need to look at is NDP polling fortunes in Quebec, and they decline right after that ruling comes out, and it's a straight downward line in Quebec to the election day. The challenge there for the NDP, they have English Canadian voters that are in favor of multiculturalism, in favor of religious accommodation, and I don't think they could realistically abandon those voters. But you have a lot of left-leaning Quebec nationalist voters in Quebec that believe the opposite. And so the NDP is put in this impossible position where they can't appeal to a lot of the left-leaning voters they need in Quebec to be the kind of party in Quebec they were in 2011 while holding on to their voters in English Canada. And the Liberal Party, because they've got a stronger base of support in Quebec amongst Anglophones, amongst Federalists, amongst ethno-racial minorities, they don't face that same dilemma. They are not as reliant on the Quebecois nationalist component of the Quebec electorate as the NDP. And so they've got a kind of strategic advantage there.
So I'm interested. Carl Nuremberg, one of our columnists, wrote a column recently about how the NDP needs to embrace a leader who is bilingual and can speak French. Heather McPherson, who some people have dubbed the front runner, that remains to be seen, does not speak French. She says she'll learn, but she has been an MP for a while now and hasn't yet to learn. It remains to be seen who the front runner is going to be. There's also Rob Ashton in the race. It doesn't look good. It looks like there's a strong possibility that they'll have a leader who's not bilingual. Do you think that that's a huge issue for the NDP?
Any party at this point that is serious about being more than a small third party probably needs a bilingual leader. There are votes in Quebec to be won, I think, for every party. And having a leader that can't speak to Quebecers is a real problem. I think some of this depends on what the NDP wants to be. Do they want to be a third party that vacillates between where they are now and kind of where they were in the 2008, kind of the pre-2011 Jack Layton years, and then where Jagmeet Singh was the last couple of elections? If they want to be that, it'd be nice for them to win votes in Quebec, but they can be a 20 to 30 seat party by winning votes in English Canada. And in an environment where the electorate's fairly fragmented, a 20 to 30 seat party is not something to be ignored. We're going to, I think, have a lot of minority governments where a party like that can have real policy influence. But there's no path to the NDP to compete for government or reach the kind of heights that they reached in 2011. Without Quebec. the reality in Canada is the way that the seats are disputed and the way that parties are competitive, you kind of need substantial shares of seats out of at least two or three regions, right? Western Canada, Ontario, and Quebec. And unless the NDP has a strategy to win rural voters in on the Western Prairies in interior British Columbia, which I think is more far-fetched than winning in Quebec, then Quebec is essential. And I don't know what the, like for a non-bilingual leader, they're not going to win the support of Quebecers.
Sorry. That's interesting, but Mark Carney didn't do that badly, and we've all seen him speak French. It's not good.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between not being good at speaking French and not being able to speak French at all.
I mean, that is fair, right? You do need to be able to speak it. If Heather McPherson had started learning French in earnest 6 years ago, she could probably be where Mark Carney is today, and that makes the difference.
Yeah, so I don't think they need a bilingual, a fluently bilingual francophone who's been speaking French since they, but they need somebody with a reasonable, they need somebody who's not going to embarrass themselves in a debate in French and is going to understand, and probably they need somebody who speaks better than like Stephen Harper or Aaron O'Toole.
And Stephen Harper actually spoke quite good French, but what was interesting about him, and I, you know, obviously I'm not a fan of Stephen Harper, but he did really commit when he decided he wanted to be in politics to becoming as bilingual as he could.
Yeah.
And that is a work ethic you need to respect for somebody who is in, from someone who's in federal politics.
I think there's space there. I think in the current moment, right, like is Heather McPherson going to be able to, and I don't know French enough and don't know her French well enough to be able to give a definitive answer to this. And the same question goes for Abby Lewis and the other candidates. Are they in a couple of years, whenever the next election happens, which could be sooner rather than later, are they going to be able to speak French well enough that they're going to be able to make a case that they can speak to and represent Quebecers? And that's an open question. Like, I don't think they need like a Tom Mulcair who grew up in Quebec and speaks fluent Quebecois French, but they need somebody who can demonstrate that they're serious about speaking to Quebec voters. But the other thing is, this doesn't solve the problem in Quebec. This is a minimum requirement for being able to compete in the province. The broader problem the NDP faces in Quebec is that the Bloc Québécois looks like a serious player again. And the Bloc Québécois supports redistribution like the NDP. They support environmental politics like the NDP does. They support gender equality and LGBTQ plus rights for the NDP does. And then on the questions that divide leftists in Quebec from leftists in English Canada, the Bloc Québécois can take positions that line up with leftists and Quebecers without any fear of losing votes in English Canada, and the NDP can't. So if we're talking about should the welfare state be run by the province or the federal government, the Bloc Québécois is always going to be a more appealing option to Quebec leftists. If we're talking about secularism and religious accommodation and diversity and immigration and that kind of stuff, the Bloc Québécois can line themselves up with a left-leaning Quebec voter in a way that the NDP can't. I don't know what the solution for the NDP to solving that problem is, but if they can't solve that problem, it's going to be very hard for them to get to where they were in 2011.
Thank you for joining us, Daniel. And where can our listeners find more of your work?
Well, thank you for having me. Right now, I'm mostly doing academic stuff. So you can check if you really want to read academic papers, you can check my SFU website or my personal website.
That was Daniel Westlake and Rabble's publisher, Sarah Sahagian, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Sarah and Daniel. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with news from Ontario. Provincial public health agencies are raising the alarm around how a lack of funding could affect the important services that they provide. Public health agencies are responsible for testing drinking water, treating and tracking communicable diseases, organizing vaccination campaigns, and more. Funding for public health agencies in Ontario in 2024 was $62.19 per capita, which is actually $5 lower than it was in 2019. This has led to issues like some drinking water sources in Ontario not being tested for bacteria. As well, it has made public health agencies unable to deal with rising cases of sexually transmitted diseases and measles outbreaks. Cases of sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis were up by over 1,600% in some parts of Ontario when compared to pre-pandemic levels. As well, Ontario saw over 2,300 cases of measles so far this year, which, in part, led to Canada losing its internationally recognized measles elimination status. Experts warn that continued lack of funding could put public health services in Ontario under further strain. Staying in Ontario, Premier Doug Ford's Progressive Conservative government passed Bill 60, which, among other things, allows for the further privatization of water. The bill allows for the creation of privately run, for-profit water companies who will then be allowed to provide water services to public organizations like municipalities. Drew Jay, Executive Director of the Council of Canadians, warned that the privatization of water risked reducing water access to Ontarians, saying, quote, "Ontario's water is safe and affordable because it's accountable to all of us. When you introduce profit into the equation, safety inevitably becomes second. Privatized water has been a disaster, and this government just fast-tracked a bill that will undermine the confidence Ontarians feel when they turn on the faucet." End quote. And finally, in Alberta politics, 14 members of the Alberta legislature are facing petitions calling for them to be recalled. If each petition passes, these 14 members would be forced to run for their seats again in special recall elections. All 14 members are part of the ruling United Conservative Party under Premier Daniel Smith. Smith's government had earlier passed new legislation making it easier for members of the public to recall elected officials. The United Conservative Party in recent months has faced heightened controversy due to using the notwithstanding clause in the Canadian Constitution to pass laws forcing striking teachers back to work, and legislation that human rights activists say violates the charter rights of trans youths in the province. As always, you can read about all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.